Thank you very much for coming and joining. I'm Mark Papke Larson. I work in Bemidji as a chaplain in an acute care hospital and also in our hospice program. I've been there for about 15 years. And the presentations that I've been giving over the week have to do with different aspects of death and dying. And today, we're trying to really focus and think about grief as how it functions, how we experience it in some ways very with a commonality, and how we experience it quite uniquely. So I've got some information that I'd like to give out to you. One of the things you've noticed, or I'm sure is, and it's just so become so much a part of me, is in the healthcare system, if I want to give a presentation, I have to at least two times say, "The studies say, the studies show." So I do that a fair amount. I haven't had anybody yet say, "What study is that, by the way? Could I see that?" But it is, in the world in which I do my ministry, the desire to be able to show how you got the information you got, and that it has been looked at by peers, and that has been that you've looked at it in several different ways, is a very important thing to show, and good thing too. How does it work? Does it work? Where does it come from? Okay. In this area of grief, one of the place that I kind of wanted to start actually was with that Bible study. How many of you here were part of that the Noah Bible, the Jonah Bible study? A few of you? Okay.
Today, you mean?
Or just over the past week have been a part of it in some way. Okay, I just want to go over that just really quickly. It was just a really neat Bible study. One of the things I think I love about Holden is that you really become a part of an ongoing conversation. You know, some of you are brand new probably to the village, just here. Others have been here for a week, having this conversation, and you'll have other ones that will just go on from here. And it's really one conversation that has been going on for a number of years. I think that's just a wonderful thing. Of the whole summer, conversation starts, more energy is added to it, people come and go and change. We just finished a week, a Bible study on the story of Jonah, and it was really well done. We started off by just trying to listen to the text. Then we heard about it as a story, its narrative, what pieces are it. Then we heard about some of the historical background. And then we started just looking at it, how do we apply that? What does all that mean for us living in our daily lives? And we kind of ended the last Bible study this morning by saying a bishop of the church told us about how he saw it in terms of the Senate, kind of opened it up for what did you folks hear. One of the historical pieces that was really interesting for me to learn about this story is how Jonah comes at a time when Israel was just headed back. They were probably back out of the exile. The Assyrians had decimated them, northern kingdom. They were taken in exile. Literally, Israelites were decapitated, skinned alive. It was an awful slaughter. They were taken away. 80 years later, they were brought back. And this story shows up when they're just kind of getting back on their feet, when they're feeling like finally they've got some place to go. And in the story, Jonah has to go back to Nineveh, which is the capital of Syria. So here's a story of these people who remember, who have relatives, grandmas and grandpas, sisters and brothers, who died at the hands of these murderers, who are getting, by the way, historically then are getting their own. They are being destroyed as the story is probably written. So there's a way in which, you know, if I were back then, good. Those Assyrians, they deserve it. And here's this story all of a sudden of Jonah, which asks them, all of those folks, and the Israelites, to think again about their relationship, you know, what is God about. I heard the story as one of a story of grief and sadness. Here's Noah,
Jonah.
I say Noah again. No. Here's Jonah. Here's Jonah, who has gone away runs away from God. God, we're not told why at the beginning, but we find out because he's worried that God will be merciful. To whom? To the people who slaughtered his family, right? And here God may be merciful to them. And he goes back and asks them to repent, and God is merciful to them. And his response, he's angry. He's angry at God because in his grief, it doesn't make any sense. He can't make sense out of it. There's no meaning to it. What do you mean you're going to be merciful to him? And as it ends, the book ends really with a question. It's a question that God asks of Noah. Should I not be concerned about Nineveh, the great city, in which there are more than 120,000 persons who did not know their right hand from their left, and all of the animals? And so in the midst of his grief, Noah is at a point where he has to decide. He has to make a choice. He has to see which way will this go. And that is, and I was so glad that it said, because as I thought with live with that, what we were talked about this morning for a little bit, that is really the way many people experience grief. There is an experience in grief in which you feel out of control, in which it swallows you alive, in which you move away from it, it swallows you, you have to live with it, and you find yourself spit back up into life. You gotta keep living life. It doesn't make a lot of sense, but you keep living it, you keep going along, and you try to make sense of it. Now, anger is one of those common ones for men. There's lots of different emotions we have. But then there comes a point when you've lived with that grief for a certain amount of time, and then you have to say, oh, things are changing. It's changing. Now, do I want to stay where it is, or do I want to go where it's leading me? Things change. So I, with that kind of introduction, when you come into this, when you're thinking about this, are there certain things, do you have certain questions or about grief and grieving that you would like to have answered? Things you've been thinking about, you know, just in your own life, from personal experiences or in general? Kinds of questions that come to your mind right off the top? Make sure, I kind of want to make sure we get those out there if some folks have them. Sure. Yeah, Joe?
I knew someone, and when they passed away, they never wanted to die. It mm-hmm. seemed like they didn't want to admit mm-hmm. it, and it felt like the white elephant in the room. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't really sure how to ever open up the topic of telling this person how important they were to me and how much I cared about them, because it felt like if I did that somehow, I was the one bringing up the subject that I wasn't going to get to see them anymore.
Right.
I didn't know how to put that into words.
Right, and they weren't, the person wasn't a very good person, but still didn't, that topic was not one that person wanted to talk about. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll definitely, what I hope at the end is to give you a couple of tools to use to help assess, one, where are people at in that conversation, and then two, how can you approach that? Do you want to, and in what ways? A couple of tools. So I'll have some handouts on that. Anyone else?
Well, I lost both my parents in the last couple of years, and both of them had lived really good, full lives. And so there was an element of joy that when they died relatively easily. And of course, we're sad to lose them. But it was a little awkward sometimes when people would approach me with this preconception that I was going through this unbearable grief over the loss of my parents.
Right.
And I wasn't. I mean,
mm-hmm.
yes, I missed them.
Mm-hmm.
But,
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So I'm not sure what the question is. But
so something to the extent of, this must be awful for you. I'm so sad that this is, how are you doing?
Yeah.
How are you doing? That kind of thing. And you know the response.
Even more than that.
The response should be awful, terrible, but you don't feel that.
No.
It's like, and if you don't say awful, it's like, well, it's actually pretty good. It's like, no. Beep, wrong answer.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Those, and in fact, that's actually what's coming up next here is to talk about some of why most of us feel like this most of the time. We feel it on both ends. We feel it when we're experiencing the grief, and we come up and you know the person is well intentioned.
Yeah.
And it's like they're trying to hurt you in a certain kind of way. And from the other side is when you have experience someone who you know has lost someone they love. How do you approach them so that you're not pushing them in a certain corner? Everybody says, you know, there is true, deep truth in that fact that there are certain times in certain grief situations where there are no words. But there are many situations in many grief experiences where there are words, where there is a way in which to verbalize something, you know, you can be with people. So, how do you assess those and do those? Yep, we'll definitely talk about that.
I think I'm anticipating, you know, aging parents, both mine and my wife's. And one of the things that I'm looking at is, okay, in a situation where there has been estrangement of one kind or another, not a lot of contact, some residual animosity and stuff, how do I prepare both myself and my parents for, you know, moving into that kind of a situation? Mm-hmm. And I don't want to be,
what I was hearing is you know that there's stuff that's coming, and there's a history there, there's a story there, and there's some unpredictability about how that story's going to play itself out, and you don't want to stir the pot and get it going here. On the other hand, you don't want to just leave it unattended either, but somehow to add the right ingredients, work with it in a way to kind of move it. Yeah.
I guess I would say if you're just kind of aware of sort of some critical settlement issues, you know, what some of the critical settlement issues are, that would just be interesting to me.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. And I think we can some of the tools that kind of help set the stage a little bit for that, so that there's a sense in which you can feel, I'm as ready as I can be for this. Yeah. Once you know the tools that I'll hand out, as I'm thinking of now, the tools that I'll hand out to you, they really come from some studies, individual studies that were done. Okay. So they are not meant to be, this is the way it's supposed to be. What they're meant to be is a way of kind of looking at it in a different light. The other thing is, when it's your own family, your own situation, it's way harder to figure it out, folks. It's way harder. Doctors are not supposed to perform surgeries on their children. Okay? Pastors are not supposed to be pastors to their families. Lawyers aren't. We don't do that. Why don't we do that? Because you are part of the story, too. When you are part of the narrative, when you're part of the story, then you see from your own way. When you're not a part of the story, then you see the larger picture much, much more. Really, grief is a narrative. It's a story. It's the stories that we tell ourselves about who we are and how we're connected with each other. Now, I want to read, no matter how organized I get. It's right here, I know it is. Oh, yeah. I'm gonna pass these out again. To just take, I think there's probably not. These are some, I've got four poems here that I'd like to pass out. Please, it's very important to me that you hand these back to me at the end, because they are copyrighted poems, and I don't have permission to reprint them, but I'm just passing them out because I don't read them real well, and I want you to see them, so when you're done, I need them back, okay? The first one is called When I Am Asked. And we'll kind of use them throughout. So just the first one, When I Am Asked. I love this. This is as I read this, that sense that grief is a part of a story and a narrative, and we're part of that. When I am asked how I began writing poems, I talk about the indifference of nature. It was soon after my mother's died, a brilliant June day, everything blooming. I sat on a gray stone bench in a lovely planted garden by the daylilies, but the daylilies were as deaf as the ears of drunken sleepers, and the roses curved inward. Nothing was black and broken, and not a leaf fell, and the sun blared endless commercials for summer holidays. I sat on a gray stone bench ringed by the ingenue faces of pink and white impatience, and placed my grief in the mouth of language, the only thing that would grieve with me. So her story, at least as I read it, her story that she tells in the midst of her grief, in the way she tells her story, she looks out and everything around her, nothing around her can speak to her and what she needs. Now I want to... One of the reasons that we struggle with our conversation, they're just difficult conversations, but one of the reasons we struggle, one of the reasons that you experience what you experience, is because about 20 years ago, or a little more than that, there was a really groundbreaking book that was called, by Kubler-Ross, we came up with what? Five stages of grief. Do you remember what those five stages are? I bet we can get them real quick.
Denial.
Anger.
Acceptance.
Bargaining.
Resolution.
And depression. Look at that. That's amazing, huh?
In that order?
No. Different order. Different order. Except you got it too close.
Except
too close.
It comes at the end.
If I move this right here, then it's the right order.
Yeah.
Okay? Look at that. This is the power of an idea. Huh? We all in this room collectively, and probably most of us individually, could come up with most of those. Right? Okay. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was a phenomenal, an amazing person, and she contributed so much to opening the conversation about grieving in this country. It's often said, we don't talk about death, we're a death-denying culture. But she did so much to start opening up the conversation about this by her observation of people who are grieving. Okay?
I thought it was people who are dying.
This is people who are dying, yeah. And then we moved it into the five stages of grief.
Which right? are substantially the same.
They're substantially the same, okay? Interestingly enough, she didn't talk about them the way we now talk about them. Five stages of grief, okay? It sounds like there's a theory here. There really is no theory behind them. This is not a theory of grieving. It's basically her observations, But there was no study. We really had, up to that point, had not studied it. We hadn't studied how people grieve, what they experience, how this group is different from this group. Why is that? What are they going through? We hadn't looked at it. Before her, really, it was basically, basically went back to what Freud had talked about. How many of you have heard of work? You have to work through your grief, right? You have to work through your grief? Of course, you know, everybody has to work through their grief. Well, that's Freud. In his book called Melancholia, he wrote about how the work of grief is to become, is to separate yourself from a non-existent object, which is the person who's dying. Okay, how many here have gone through that? Separate yourself from a non-existent object. Nobody. Freud was really at the beginning of that. That's not how we experience it. In fact, most people who are grieving, the struggle is, how do I stay attached in a new way? My son was 20 years old. This is a situation. My son was 20 years old when he was killed tragically in a car accident. How do I stay attached to him? How do I remember him? What do? Every year when that comes up? Why every year when that comes up do I feel so sad? Huh? What do I do? How do I? It's not I need to distance myself from my son. Well, I would never want to forget my son. Ever. Why would I want, I can't forget, but I want somehow to be in relationship with him. But it's got to be different than it was.
Mm-hmm. There's somebody more recently, I forget who, I didn't read the book but heard about it, identified yearning as one of the key features of grief.
Mm-hmm. Yearning is a key part. Some people, it is a key part of it. For some people.
Yeah.
For some people, it's not. For some people, the yearning to be with, again, just isn't there. Mom lived a full life. She was a decent human being. And, you know, she suffered a lot those last 5 years. And it's okay she's not here. I miss her. Yeah, I miss her. I'm not saying I don't miss her. But, man, you know, it's okay. And I don't have a deep, deep yearning. I mean, yeah, but it's okay.
Well, maybe the yearning happened 5 years ago.
It happened. It could have happened, but what I'm talking about too is that there's anticipatory grief, but there's been a lot of work in terms of building the theory, and part of what we struggle with, folks, is that this is inner consciousness, so we try to fit grief into these categories.
Elizabeth Kubler-Ross made those observations, and we misunderstood it if we've taken it as a prescription.
I did. That's right. I did. We have in our healthcare system, we have an amazing system where electronically now we can tap into most of the journal articles that are published across this wide spectrum of healthcare journals. So I did a search on studies on Elizabeth on the five stages of grief. And now if I'd done it on grief, I would have come up with, you know, 5,600 hits, right? This one, you know, one study. That study looked at these and they said, yes, indeed, certain percentage of time these are experienced. But these are emotions. These are mostly emotions. These are mostly individual experiences. In other words, I can have denial. I can deny this. Well, denial's not going to.
No.
That was a really bad one. I can be angry about something. But I can also be at the same moment accepting that it's going on. They're not mutually exclusive because they're emotions, they're not systems. So this troubles our sleep in many ways when it comes to grief. What happened, I wasn't angry. I didn't go through denial. Is that, that'll be coming then, probably. I'll wait for that later. I never did get angry. Is there something wrong with me? I should have been angry. Why was I angry about that? I don't feel angry. Okay, those kinds of things. So enough on that. So what I want to pass out now is
you have challenged assumptions. So these are things that aren't necessarily true, but are common assumptions.
That's right.
Okay.
These are, and what I'm passing out now is one of the things that one of the places where those assumptions have been challenged. Did everybody get one of these the first time? Copies of them? Pretty much? Okay.
It strikes me that at least in Minnesota culture, one of the issues is that people aren't have a certain amount of time prescribed that other people will let them do.
I'm sorry, I was thinking about my next thing.
That's
could
right.
you please say that again?
It strikes me that people are prescribed how long other people will let them grieve. Mm-hmm.
That kind of experience happens, yeah. Because we have in our minds a certain kind of idea about what grief should look like and what it should be like.
Right.
Right. I'd like to read this, as you're passing out, I'd like to read this poem that is just, the beauty of this poem is in the way that it kind of, for me, it sums up a little bit culturally how we've taken these ideas and we say, by the way, you won't find this poem in yours on the ones, this is a separate one, that sums up these ideas when we take and try to make them into a theory of how we respond to grief. It's called The Five Stages of Grief. Last night I lost you. Someone pointed me towards the five stages of grief. Go that way, they said. It's easy. Learn to climb stairs after an amputation. And so I climbed. Denial first. I sat down at breakfast, carefully setting the table for two. I passed you the toast. You sat there. I passed you the paper. You hid behind it. Anger seemed so familiar. I burned the toast, snatched the paper, read the headlines myself. But they mentioned your departure, so I moved on to bargaining. What could I exchange for you? The silence after the storm? My fingertips? My typing fingers? Before I could decide, depression came puffing up, a poor relation, its suitcase tied with a string. And in the suitcase, there were bandages for my eyes and bottles of sleep. I slid all the way down the stairs, feeling nothing. And all the time, hope flashed on and off in decorative neon. Hope was the signpost pointing straight up in the air. Hope was my uncle's middle name. He died of it. After a year, I'm still climbing, though my feet slip on your stone face. The tree line has long since disappeared. The green is a color that I have forgotten. But now I see what I am climbing towards. Acceptance, written in capital letters. A special headline, acceptance. It's in the lights. I struggle on, waving and shouting. Below, my whole life spreads its stuff. All the landscapes I've ever known or dreams of it. Below, a fish jumps, the pulse in your neck. Acceptance, I finally reach it, but something is wrong. Grief is a circular staircase. I have lost you. Reactions to that poem? Anyone want to share?
Grief is a circular staircase.
I've lost you.
I've lost you. But the I was struck with the grief is a circular staircase. It keeps, those pieces keep coming back and coming back. It's not about accomplishing more.
If one of the pieces of a different, than what I'll show you, one of the different approach to grief says that we're not really, what happens in our culture is that we're really a grief-denying culture. That what we fear the most is to allow the grief, whatever it is, in. And so we don't really learn from it, and we keep pushing it away. And what happens when we keep pushing it away, we're pushing it into certain boxes, is that we can't learn from it, so we can't learn the lesson that it has to teach us. The paper that passed out to you is from a study that was done and this study, I've mentioned it before, it's just a really fascinating study. It was done on a group of It was done on a group of individuals who, before one of the individuals who'd been married, couple, they're fairly specific, couples who'd been married, who both of whom were healthy, reported that they had satisfactory marriages when they were both well, and the study was followed, and then one of them would got sick, ill, and died, and they were interviewed along the way, this process, okay? And then when they were done, they took the interviews and they looked at them carefully as to how people experienced their grief. Okay. So now what you see there, what you've got, I want to be really careful with the limits of this. The limits are that it's from the predominant culture. The limits are that it's done with married couples, men and women. There's a lot of limits in this study. So what's important is not to take the study and say, okay, this is how people are going to be. Okay, but what is helpful in this study is that it changes the perspective of grief as a problem or an illness, something that's got to be cured or taken care of that way. It changes it into something that is a lived out of the stories, the narratives that people live. So I'd like us just to look at that for just a little bit. I'll explain it briefly, what you're looking at, and then we're going to go through some of these assumptions that are challenged by this information. And I think, if you think about your own experiences, these assumptions are challenged oftentimes in people's life experiences. Okay? So as you're looking about this, up in the upper left, grief reactions assessment grid, and what you're seeing here is what we are incorporating into our hospice program now as a way of helping the hospice team members to think about how they're going to respond to grief situations that they encounter. Instead of having one size fits all, everybody gets the same letter, everybody gets visited 2 weeks after the death, everybody gets to try to think about how can we do grief response that meets the needs of individuals, okay? So on the first column that's going up and down, it says general orientation to meaning story. That column talks about what people bring into the situation. It's the story, their life narrative, the narrative that they've been telling each other, the story. The first approach is generally positive. Generally healthy relationships and ability to navigate life's difficulty. So when I'm a hospice nurse doing that assessment, or the chaplain, you're hearing about the story, you're listening, and you're already hearing these things. It's not like you have to say, ask special questions here, right? You're hearing about how it was when they got cancer. You're hearing about how it was for mom when she got it, and now it's like this. You're hearing those stories, okay? Are they generally positive? Do they feel like they can navigate these difficulties? Or is it generally negative? Trouble or difficult relationships, difficult in managing the lives, you know. No, I don't really have any caregivers. No, I don't have anybody who would do that. Well, yeah, I got kids in the community, but that won't work. No, it just won't work. That's the life story, the life narrative. And on the top, generally approach to understanding the meaning of loss. Okay? There's two general approaches that they came out of the study. One was assimilate the loss into the current meaning story. So in other words, this loss makes sense. Yeah, he smoked a lot like a train. We told him to stop. We did everything we can, and now he's got cancer. And somehow he kind of fits into that life story. Or the other one is accommodation of the loss. In other words, you have to change the meaning of the story to fit with loss. We're getting ready for retirement. He was a runner. He was out there all the time. He ate that stuff without any flavor for years. And here we are. Okay? It doesn't make sense. It's gotta fit it in. So those are the two basic approaches, okay? Then if you come across, so if you read across, then you, from the positive approach and assimilates loss, they found in this study that there was a group, about 46%, okay, not quite half of this group of people were what you call resilient grievers. That is, they accepted the loss without significant grief reactions. Okay? Now that means that they were, I'll go into a little more detail on each one of them. Okay, the other one, the other section coming across with a positive approach, but they had to make new meaning, accommodate new meaning. They're the common grievers, that is, folks who they were healthy coping with their grief reactions, but they had to have a new understanding. They had to figure out something was different and new in it. And then there's the chronic grievers, those folks for whom they have a basically healthy relationship, but they can't quite figure out that meaning. So it stays with them longer. And they have to work it, they're about 60%. It takes them longer, okay? I want you to notice too, the risk factor. We'll get to that in just a second. Chronic, and then down at the bottom, negative approaches, the chronic depressed grievers. I was depressed before my husband got cancer, and I'm depressed now that he's got cancer, and I'm gonna be depressed after he gets cancer, okay? I mean, after he dies and I have to go on. And then the depressed improved group. That's the folks who you hear basically negative approach. It was tough when we started. And then after the death, they do much better. About 10% of the folks, they're not depressed anymore. They're getting along with their life.
Okay. Some of those perhaps are spousal abuse situations where there's some freedom.
Sure, some of those are. Some of those are spousal abuse. Some of those are situations where the illness process was so bad that, you know, how long can I be there? I stopped my life for 2 years to take care of this person I love, and I still love them, and I wouldn't change that for anything. I did what I needed to do, but it was really hard, and it was really hard. And then they died, and I did what I needed to do. And by golly, I'm just really relieved that it's over. Is that all right? Is it okay to be relieved? Because mostly I feel just okay. I mean, I want to go out. I haven't been out for 2 years. I'm gone to a movie. You know what I mean? Those kinds of. Mm-hmm.
Just my first reaction to this is it looks like the people who respond the best are people whose current life meaning framework is one that is already geared to accommodate possible losses in the future.
I got a little bit stuck when you said the best.
Not best, but I mean the most resilient or the healthiest.
Which one are you talking about?
The upper left quadrant.
Yeah. So that the resilient grievers?
Right. The resilient grievers, it looks like, are people who already have in their framework of understanding life an ability to accommodate losses in general.
In this study, they were those folks were the ones who the loss of their partner, they could assimilate it into their meaning structure. And it's not talking about general, okay? But they were the ones who were able to do that. Again, what the reason this was so helpful for me personally was because it said, stop trying to fit people into the categories, but start listening carefully to what they have to say. What is the story that they have to tell you? And if you can hear the story they have to tell you, it will help you be able to figure out how to respond to them. So I just want to give you a little bit more information on that one and that category you're talking about. It'd be the resilient grievers. Those, about half of us, 46% in this study, about 46, they were generally satisfied with their relationship. They were attached to their spouse. They had good memories of the deceased. They, after the deceased died, they tend to idealize the deceased person. That gives those of us who leave first, good. It's good enough. They're going to idealize me when I'm gone. They had least regrets about their relationships. Okay, we said what we needed to say. Interesting, in these studies they did, those folks, you don't need to have go to a grief group. Okay, in fact, those folks, if you send them too much information, they start to worry about why am I doing something wrong here? But that group tended to have a low, not really high sense of yearning. They didn't, I mean, they missed the person, but there wasn't that deep yearning that is there for other folks. They didn't think and talk about it a lot. They felt, I mean, the thought was still there. They still remember that person, but it wasn't something they dwelt on all the time. It was something that had a sense of, oh, I'm thinking about that person now. That's okay. I feel sad. It's okay. Now I can do the next thing. Watch my time here. Yeah. So the reason I pass that out for you is because what I really want to do is to say this model is very, very limited. The model we carry in our head is very limited. This is one study. If this study became the model, that would be very, very limited. Okay? But it's enough of a change so that we're using it in our hospice program to try to help us break out of this mold. We're trying to help us move in a little bit broader direction for it. Okay? So to get to the tools, one more thing to pass out, because it's already 5 o'clock here. I'm going really quick. That's it. I'm passing those out. I want to. There's a little bit more poetry here I'd like to read. Actually, just keep this one on for right now. Keep the grief and the reaction top on sheet on the top, and listen to this and see if you can kind of hear where this person might fit into one of those reactions, okay? Condoleezza Rice said, "Struggle and sorrow are not licensed to give way to self-doubt and to self-pity or to defeat. It is an opportunity to find a reward, rewarded spirit, a renewed spirit and a renewed strength to carry on. How else but through struggle are we going to get the full measure of the Lord's capacity for innovation in our lives? If there are no burdens, how can we know how he asks us to lift ourselves up?" Okay. Well, there's a person who's pretty resilient, and the loss is going to fit into her framework, right? What it is. I have a poem here from Rumi. I won't read it, but it definitely fits into that resilient category, let me tell you. Because that's, of course, when I read his poetry, you can just feel that in what he says. How about this one? Just see if you can hear this one in the context of one of these categories. This is from Emily Dickinson. "We grow accustomed to the dark when light is put away, as when a neighbor holds a lamp to witness her goodbye. A moment we uncertain step for newness of the night, then fit our vision to the dark, meet the road erect, and so of larger darknesses, those evenings of the brain, when not a moon discloses a sign, nor or star come out within, the bravest grope a little, and sometimes hit a tree directly in the forehead. But as they learn to see, either the darkness alters, or something the sight adjusts itself to midnight, and life steps almost straight." You can hear her accommodating, her asking, accommodating to that darkness, and then stepping forward. Here's another one, and this was written by Mert and Irene Strumman. Their son was killed in a tragic accident. He was actually hit by lightning, and they wrote a book in response to it. This is was a letter that was sent to Irene from a friend of hers. As this friend writes to Irene and says, as I stood with Tom by Naomi's grave, that's his friend's daughter's grave, by Naomi's grave, for the first and perhaps only time, a tremendous peace filled me. The old tugging whys were no more. There was only an incredible joy, a gratitude that Naomi had been born and that she had lived her abbreviated life so richly. And that my own life now continues. I suppose we shall never cease wondering what if, but I just wanted to bear witness that the years do bring acceptance that bears God no grudge, and the black stone of grief marvelously grows smoother with the long handling of it. As long as Samuel Longfellow's hymn so beautifully puts it, thou leadest me by unseen, unsought ways, the truest my mornings to praise. Thanks be to God. So her image of that stone is as as a sharp black stone that grows smoother with the handling of it. Grief is that. So here are some of these myths that those things challenge. Individuals need to work through their loss. That comes way back from Freud, that what our, the goal of loss is to become detached from that person, okay? But that the current studies, the one I showed you and many other ones, challenge that. The other thing that challenges, grief is one of life's most stressful events reflected in the strong grief reactions of the bereaved. But as you can see from that study, there are actually many of them don't have strong grief. Most of those folks, if you don't do anything, will come to a place of feeling at peace, that they've done what they needed to do. Most of the time, we can get in the way if we try to do too much. Okay? The absence of grief is often a sign of unacknowledged problems related to the loss. Well, he just hasn't cried yet. There's something must be wrong. When facing major losses, most, if not all, people are motivated to search for meaning. This is in a difference comes out of a different study than one you have, but actually, turns out that there's a pretty good group of people who don't need to seek any different meaning in it at all. Those who just say accommodated. And of those who do seek meaning, having experienced major loss, most people find meaning, resolve what has happened, and move on with their lives. Well, this other study that was done, there was a number of people whose meaning basis was shaken. A year later, they still hadn't found meaning. They still hadn't figured out any meaning, and they were doing what they were figuring out their life. But most of us assume that we have to find this meaning before you can move on with life. Well, many people were living their lives, moving on with life, but they hadn't figured out the meaning for that particular event.
Probably my statement will say the kind of person I am, but what do you mean by finding meaning in death?
I mean that the person died too young. I just can't make any sense of it. I can't make any meaning out of that. It just doesn't make any sense. I know that the ground, I know it was slippery. I know that she was a young driver and she got caught in the slush and it pulled her off. All of that's true. I understand that, but it doesn't make any sense why she would. She had so much going for her. She was contributing. She was really a strong person in the community. She was only 20 years old. That makes no sense. I can't make meaning of that. But they are living their lives. They continue to live our lives.
So the kind of old assumption, cause and effect, this person died because of this? Is that?
Sometimes that's how people make meaning. Sometimes they, but to find a meaning that comes out of it, well, she donated, and there's somebody now who's got a heart, mm-hmm. who's living
because of
her, and these good things have come out of it. That's finding meaning in it.
Can it also mean integrating it into your story? Not necessarily cause and effect, but it becomes part of your story and who you are and how you tell it, and it has its place.
It has its, you can fit it into your, you can fit it into your story. You can find the meaning. Well, yeah, that's a better way of putting it. Fit in a story. And there are a number of people for whom that never happens. It never fits into the story. It's just not right. It never fits in. But they can find their way.
See, and I challenge that theologically too, because God doesn't promise all the answers. You know, we admire Job for his patient suffering, and Job never knows why he was suffering. The reader is told, but Job isn't.
That's right. You know? And it's really true.
So part of finding meaning can be living with that mystery.
Well,
living with that question.
Living with unanswered questions mm-hmm. is way more important way for Christians to be in the world than finding all the answers. And I get really suspicious of people who have all the answers and can explain the meaning of everything.
God just wanted this little girl in his arms.
Yeah. He needed another angel in heaven.
God takes the best flowers for his bouquet.
Yeah.
Right. And that one particularly, the image of the God with the snipping off babies for bouquet is fairly troubling.
Yeah.
At the same time, I have heard parents say that.
Yeah.
And when they say that, what they mean is, I think, is the world is out of control. There's nothing. What is most important to me, I have no longer. The person I love the most, I have no longer. So, is the world full of utter chaos or what? No. God is taking care of it. I don't understand, but God is taking care of it. That's where my baby is now, is with God. And then they use a phrase that they got somewhere.
One of the most hurtful things, I think, is to say, well, it was God's will. And of course, so much is.
Well, if the grieving person says it, that's one thing. If someone tries to convince a grieving person of that, that's when it gets hurtful.
It's God. When people say it's God's will, as if to impose the meaning onto the story, that's when it's a problem. When it comes from within, then you have to keep kind of listening to what it has and where it goes.
But it strikes me that if somebody is saying it's God's will, you need to listen quite carefully, because it could be that somebody else has imposed that language onto them and they feel that that's what's proper to say.
In northern Minnesota, there was a couple who adopted two kids from Europe. I think it was Russia, two kids. And they were part of a fundamentalist community, and those two kids wandered off late fall, went on the ice, and fell through and drowned in a pool up behind the community, up behind their house. And it was a very sad event, and they, in the course of the sermon and all of that, they talked about God's will and trusting God and all that process. And so they adopted another child, and they didn't put a fence up because they were trusting in God. And it happened. Right? So it is important the language we use. Okay? But we have to ask the question of who's using language and how is it being used? What does it mean in that context? Because I've also been in the same context that the language reflects the meaning of the story. And so we have to listen very carefully to what that is. And in that context, you know, when somebody says it in the midst of immediate grief, I think they want that control. But if they keep saying it and keep forcing that the story has to have a certain ending to it, that's when they get in trouble. I'm kind of digressing because I want to get to this last piece and I'm almost out of time. Finding meaning in major loss is a critical importance to successful adjustment and adaptation to major loss. Okay? Now, these are assumptions that we all have been making. I make these assumptions. These are pretty deeply ingrained in us. They come out of a certain model, but they aren't necessarily true. Okay? If you want to look at that last sheet now, what single most important tool is listening? all of the studies that I have cited, actually that I've used the whole week, any of them, they all come when the healthcare community has said to people who are grieving, to people who are dying, to people who are ill, what is it like when this happens to you? Listening. It's the listening piece that is so much at the heart of what it's about. And listening for what's being said. This study was done of a group of folks who were dying of cancer. And again, it's limitations. They're dying of cancer, okay? And there are certain age parameters, but they were asked, what is it like? Tell me about it. Tell us about your life. Tell us about the things that you've struggled with. What's it like? How is this with cancer? When they took those, they came up with these seven basic narratives or stories they would tell. What was amazing is that the stories were very consistent. Okay? People would consistently take the illness process they're dying now and fit it into their life story and therefore set the course for how they were dying. Now think about this in the question you asked, Joanne, about opening up the topic. Think about the person and her life story and what it was, okay? These life narratives, the first one is, that life narrative is that of struggle. Life is difficult and requires tremendous effort. I've worked hard for everything all my life, and it has always been a struggle. Nothing's ever come easy, and oftentimes this is the person who dies in pain and struggles all the way to the very end of their life. Now, because of time, I just want to pick one. My sister developed breast cancer, and when she was originally diagnosed, she had 4 lymph nodes that were already involved in cancer, which is not a good sign. And she responded well initially to the chemo, very well, as a matter of fact. And it's one of those classic stories where she was just about to that point where the physician would say, you don't have to come back for another 5 years. Like a visit away. And they found it and came back. And it came back with a vengeance, as it often does. And they used every chemo under the book, everything in the sun. She's 3 years older than I am. She has kids who are a little younger than I am. All of her kids were in high school when it came back a second time. Her three boys and her husband lived on a farm. They're all together. My sister was number 3, the triumph of the inner strength. Her theme was endurance. My sister was endurance. She approached her illness with a kind of inner strength. Taking control of difficult events, facing them, often with an upbeat approach. She was the one who, when my mom passed away, took all my mom's jewelry, assigned it into piles, wrote information on each one, and then gave that jewelry to each one of us. Here, this is for you. This, and not one of my siblings ever questioned her. I guarantee you, didn't. My brother's here, but no, here's your pop, thank you very much. She was in charge kind of person. She did those kinds of things. She didn't want to talk about her illness. However, my life narrative is not endurance and inner strength. I wanted to talk about it. I said, how can we do that? I tried to figure it. She didn't want to do that. A week before, about a week and a half before she died, she got sick and was in the hospital. And I guarantee you, we didn't go down there whenever she was sick. We didn't visit. We visited on the normal times you would visit. That's when you come and stay. But we all showed up at her hospital room, and the whole family showed up, and it was very touching. We told stories, talked a lot about her kids being in the state fair and the bulls and the cattle they were showing, and how good that was going. We talked about
school,
those kinds of things. We all sat around as a family. In there talking about that, and then came time to leave. I went over and did something which was unusual for my family. I reached over and I gave her a peck on the cheek and a hug. My sister-in-law's laughing. It's okay. And And I, you know, I just said goodbye, and we're going to take off. I said that, and she said, thank you very much for coming, in a very gentle way, which, you know, and then she added, you don't have to come every time I get in the hospital. And which, it, from my own life story, was permission for me to go on a fishing trip with my buddies that we had planned every year. But her sense was endurance and strength. She planned out 6 months or 4 months of her teaching schedule, you know, the next teaching schedule. She didn't have, she's a small school system, she didn't have to leave that school system. They let her stay as long as she wanted to be the teacher in her classroom, okay? Even though she couldn't do it anymore physically. Endurance and inner strength. When I understood this, using this thing, when I had read over that enough times and I could see her in that, then I could stop. I didn't have to have the conversations I had to have with her. Because I needed to have those conversations, so I had them with other people. But her life story, that's the way it was written. That's the way it was written, and she held on to it all the way through. Okay? The strength in that is that it allows you options. So I suggest, think about people in your life that you love. Now, again, the closer they are, the harder it is to see that pattern. I guarantee you, the harder it is. But if you think about somebody just that you know and who's these patterns, what they do is, very careful, they don't predict. Okay? This isn't to go out and say, oh, you're a strength, you're going to do this. But it's to say, what is the story they're telling me? And if you can listen for that story, it will give you clues then and how to respond. Thank you. We're over our time. We are way over our time. If you need to get up and leave, please, I should have said that earlier, please feel free to do that at any time, okay? I just want to flip it over and say the last one. Is called reading the emotional compass. When you're having those conversations, okay, this is really a way of working with the emotion and allowing it to speak, asking it to speak to you. So fear is really about discernment. If I am afraid of something, I need to figure something out to discern it. If I can discern that, my fear will be eased. I will be able to figure it out. If I was working with a young man in his 30s who was dying of pancreatic cancer, who needed to tell his 10-year-old son, okay? Oh, we went through all kinds of plans. The chaplain can tell him, oh, please, no, Lord, no, no, it's not, okay? His mother can tell him. His grandma can tell him. And he always came back, I gotta tell him, I'm the dad. I can't tell him. How can I tell my 10-year-old son? What would I say to him? So we ran through, this is one way to, how would you, I'll be your son, tell me how you do, went through a different way. And he finally was able to tell his son. When he worked through the fear, he discerned what he needed to do. When he figured out that the chaplain couldn't do it, when he figured out he had to do it, his fear was eased. When he figured out some ways he might approach it, his fear was eased, so he could have that conversation. And afterwards, his dying was not as hard as he thought it was going to be. Because, of course, he had done the most difficult thing you could ever do. Dying was easier, he said, compared to telling my son. So his fear, when he discerned his fear, it went down. Anger is energy. In talking with people who are coming to the end of their life, if they're angry, what is it they need to do? What do we need to do? If you can do something, go ahead. I'm sorry, if you can do something, that helps. Sadness, healing, shame, and guilt, there's the same things. If we can listen to those emotions, if you can identify the emotion and ask, what are they trying to tell me, then you can often find a way through it. The struggle is when somebody is fearful, I tend to feel fearful, right? Somebody's scared, what's wrong? And my fear will go right up, they don't even have to tell me what it is, I'm scared too, right? So this is a way for us, when you start feeling those emotions, to ask where they're leading us. So those are the tools, and I hope, like you were saying, prepare to ask, what's their story? Because sometimes if you know their story, then you can say, okay, you know, the great one, I've said, it's the unresolved and unresigned. I've worked with people in hospice. They are so emotionally upset. It's their whole life, and we work hard to help them get through it and just stay upset. Sorry. Any more questions?
Before we go, could you answer the few questions that people brought up at the meeting?
Sure. How do you open up the topic? You listen carefully to their story, because that will tell you what you need to ask. For my sister, opening up the topic of with her dying, I knew that if I did that with her directly, she wouldn't talk about it. She would shut down because she didn't want to talk about it. So I had to do that conversation with somebody else. There are other people in here, when you read the story, you feel like they come in like the quester. Number six, me. For me, we were driving away when my mom passed away, and I said, maybe I'll be like my mom and not talk about it. You know, and Linnaeus laughs, pokes me in the ribs, and said, oh, we won't be able to get you to shut up. You know, so if you hear this, that will help you. This one was the preconceptions. How do you deal with the preconceptions? Know that you've got them. What's that?
That was a question about people preconceive what you need.
Right.
When you're
trying to push you into certain.
When they try to push you, probably what they're doing is they got a model in their head for how you're supposed to react. So if you know that, then, for me anyway, if they start pushing me, I don't feel it's uncomfortable because I know they're trying to, and so that I can say to them, I'm really okay. Yes, it was sad, but you know, she's better off. And I take a lot of comfort from that. So if you can know they're pushing you, not because they're right and you just missed a step, darn it, but that there just really are different ways to approach it. There really, really are. And the last one is to anticipate. Anticipate, again, if you can listen to their story, and if you can meet your own within yourself, I'm fearful that this might happen. And so what then do I need to discern? What do I need to get in place? Or shame is a powerful one, especially coming online. I feel shame. But what boundaries, what limits to cross, and how can I put them back in place? Maybe not exactly the way they were, but even symbolically.
Well, I think that those things would be really helpful doing in conjunction, because even if you're fearful and you discern what, you know, after some work and thinking what you might need to do, and then turn it around and take the context of that person's story, that can change. If you can put all kinds of energy into someone, but if you realize that they're the kind of person that the pattern is such that it's not going to make any difference, then you can even rest in the knowledge of that and right. figure out what,
right.
Or vice versa,
or you may still need to do something, mm-hmm. but then you, in your heart, you can know I did what I needed to do.
Right.